My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. I hope you're all doing okay and ready for a new episode. This week, I have the pleasure of being joined by filmmaker Dan Wayne, whose film, Big Fur, features the story of Ken Walker's quest to enter a life-size reproduction of Patty, based on the 1967 Patterson-Gimlin film, into the 2015 World Taxidermy Championships. Ken also joins us, which I was delighted with, as I've wanted to speak with Ken since I saw him interviewed on the marvellous Expedition Sasquatch Part 2 by Mountain Beast Mysteries. If you've not seen Justin's brilliant Expedition Sasquatch Part 2, I've put a link in this week's show notes for you to check it out. We discuss the film, taxidermy, Ken's Bigfoot fighting, cryptozoology, and much more. A big thank you to both Dan and Ken for joining me on this week's show. Other than that, we've got a couple of big announcements coming soon, so keep your eyes peeled for some exciting updates. Thanks again for some more merchandise orders. The mugs and stickers are flying out of our Redbubble store, so make sure you can check it out when you can by going on Redbubble and looking for Mysteries and Monsters. As always, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, which continues to grow. Once again, thank you for the lovely comments from Glenn, Emily, Steffi, Wynne, Carl, Lisa, Ian, Andy, Mel and Ricardo this week. It really is appreciated. Thanks for taking the time to drop me a line. And if you fancy dropping me a line yourself, you can just do so at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com if you want to come on the show, got any feedback, or you just want to say hello. Right. Take care, have yourselves a great week, and let's join Dan and Ken to talk about the brilliant documentary, Big Fur. This week, I am delighted to be joined by two guests. One is the producer and director of the fantastic documentary, Big Fur, Dan Wayne, and the other is the subject matter of this film, Ken Walker. Ken is a three-time world taxidermy champion, and Big Fur is the story of his recreation of the legendary Patty from the Bluff Creek film. Gentlemen, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Paul.
So, gentlemen, Big Fur, wonderful film, an extremely interesting subject matter because we're covering both the worlds of taxidermy, which I knew next to nothing before I ever discovered who Ken was. How on earth did this wonderful amalgamation of taxidermy and Bigfoot come to fruition? What was the germination process here, chaps?
Well, I was looking for a... I decided I wanted to make a movie about taxidermy, a documentary, because I was very interested in the subject, and, you know, I was... you know, wanted to show that it's really a legitimate form of art. And as I was learning about taxidermy, I became more interested in the characters that were practicing it. And Ken was one of those characters. And I was following along on an internet forum that they all hang out on. And I approached Ken about it. And he was pretty interested in being involved. And I had never really thought about Bigfoot twice before. I talked to Ken, but he was obviously, you know, has an intense interest in the subject. And when he told me he was going to make a Bigfoot, I knew that I had found my movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, as I touched on there, I don't know much about taxidermy other than, you know, what I've seen in certain shops that are around where I live. Where I live, there's a big antique quarter, so there's a lot of stuffed heads of varying quality, shall I say. And the one thing that struck me, as I touched on, getting to hear about Ken and his reputation, was that I simply didn't appreciate the art of taxidermy. And I think that's a wonderful strand that runs through the film, is not only that it's introducing us to the world of taxidermy, it is a real art form, because it's the dedication and time and care and love that people put into this subject is phenomenal.
Yeah, and you know what interests me, I think, most about it is that kind of marriage of art and science. You know, you can't do good taxidermy unless you understand anatomy, and there's certainly a scientific element, not only to, you know, the natural history and preserving these specimens, which of course some of them don't even exist on the planet anymore, but you have to have this kind of this marriage of art and science in order to produce a good product. And with good, you know, there's a big difference between good taxidermy and bad taxidermy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ken, it's very interesting, because I know in the beginning of the film you talk about, as a child, you were basically making film. You sort of doing claymation, model making films.
That's right. That's right. I was a huge Ray Harryhausen, fan, watching The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and Valley of Guanji and all that crazy stuff. And I was a weird kid, you know. I mean, I just was intensely interested in things like that. And I had to apply myself. It was just, the stories still abound in the family about the weird stuff I used to do. But that's, you know, and it kind of amalgamated with my love into my love for the wilderness and wanting to preserve the things that are there.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting, because you obviously were a very creative person before the taxidermy bug bit you, because I think you say you stumbled across a book in the library and from that point on you were sort of, it looked like that's where your creative talent was drawn to.
Yeah, it was an outlet for it, because, you know, back then there wasn't schools for special effects for movies, which is what I really wanted to do when I was that young. And then of course I didn't want to work bagging groceries and things like that, and had no interest in the technical aspects of my father's business. I just wanted to create, and I wanted to, you know, do different things. And I knew that if I could at least follow my passions, I could excel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's some wonderful, when they're talking to your family, there's some wonderful anecdotes about the variety of things that people would find in the family freezers. And I did like the story you were saying about your mum taking an eagle out of the freezer because she thought it was a turkey for dinner.
Yeah, that was a fun day. The story sounds a lot nicer than the actual event, but you know, because she had six kids to feed, and when you defrost a stinky predator instead of a big fat turkey, it tends to spoil the mood when it comes time to make supper.
Oh, very much so. I mean, it is. It really made me chuckle as well a lot, the film. There's a lot of heartwarming stories, and there's clearly a lot of respect and love for you, Ken, in your family and your friends, primarily because, you know, as you touch on, I can fully understand your self-description as a weird kid, because I was a weird kid as well.
Yeah, that's the only way to be.
I think it certainly makes childhood a lot more interesting. So, I mean, so obviously, Dan, when you came across Ken's story, I mean, obviously Big Fur is essentially the story of Ken's quest to create Patty and display her. And obviously we go through all the expo and the conference itself and the fact that, I mean, I found that very interesting as well, Ken, when you take Patty, that you have to go into a special category that's only just being designated, because obviously scientifically Bigfoot doesn't exist.
Well, yes, and there's actually more to that story. I had really not planned to put her in recreations like it says in the film, because I knew that it would cause too much controversy.
We had to create a little drama there.
Yeah, well, it did. Well, the thing is, word actually got out that I was bringing this thing, and two of the competitors in that category actually lodged formal complaints. And I knew that would happen. And so I really hadn't planned to put her into that category because I'm not at these shows to cause any kind of controversy because, you know, Larry's a good friend of mine who runs a show, and I don't want to cause him any trouble. But at the same time, we were doing the movie, and I knew that it would be awesome for the show. It would be the talk of the show. And I think it had made the newspapers. And, of course, when people came to pay their, you know, $10 to come in and see the display, people were lined up around the block, which doesn't usually happen because everybody wanted to see this Sasquatch. Well, needless to say, at the wind-down party, all my drinks were covered by Larry, so we were good.
I mean, Dan, obviously, as you touch on, you were looking to make a film about taxidermy. What, with the greatest respect, you know, I've spoken to Ken offline, and obviously I'm all in on this subject, so my eyebrows would not be raised, but I would imagine for a gentleman like you, did it make you take a step back and think, is this the right direction for what I want to do here, or did you just think, this is amazing, I've got to catalogue this?
Yeah, you know, I've always been fascinated by taxidermy, you know, luckily all these pieces fell into place, I think. You know, Ken's a good subject, and he's also fun to hang around with. There were a couple other people I was thinking about making, you know, using as a subject, and later as I got to know them, I thought, thank God I didn't choose them, because I spent 5 years with these people, you know. So, you know, Ken was fun. We became friends, and it was fun to hang out with them, and it worked out pretty well. But, yeah, there's a lot you can show, and in Ken's case, you know, to me, it's a little more interesting than most other taxidermists. You know, all taxidermists, well, almost all of them, the really good ones specialize in, you know, different forms of taxidermy. Some do birds. You know, you've got Jack Fishwick over there in your neck of the woods, who's, you know, clearly one of the greatest, you know, bird taxidermists. And you've got people that just do fish. Hmm. And then Ken is known in that world for his recreations, which is a very unique form of taxidermy. And he made an Irish elk, and he made a giant panda, and he made a saber-toothed tiger, and these really, you know, created a big splash when he shows them. And so, you know, the Bigfoot was a natural progression in that grouping of, you know, yeah, it wasn't entered into the recreations division, but it is, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's a recreation, just like his other animals were. And so that was a real exciting, you know, way to take the movie, as opposed to just showing, you know, somebody mounting a bear.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was very interesting for me because I know you touch on, I mean, the Irish elk was absolutely stunning. And like you say in the film, they've not been seen for, what, the best part of 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. And for you to get that level of recreation, it is jaw-dropping. I mean, my respect level for both you as an artist and taxidermy has gone to a different level because, like, you know, with the greatest respect, I knew next to nothing about it. Now I have a complete newfound respect for the art of it. And I know you touch on that a couple of times in the film, both Dan as the narrative and obviously yourself, Ken. That, do you think there's some kind of stigma that that's why it's not classed as art and people kind of look down their noses at people in taxidermy?
Absolutely. The stigma comes from, you know, there is a movement that is very, and this is the key word, folks, lucrative, very lucrative to play upon people's emotions and fears and things like that. We see it all the time. Mm. And the industry of animal rights is unbelievably lucrative. It began, I think it was sometime in the 60s or 70s. There was an actual attempt to stop poaching of elephants in one of the places in Africa. It could have been Kenya. And so they started a fund, and they expected to raise $800,000. And they ended up raising over $8 million. And that turned a lot of heads. Yeah. And so what ended up happening was everybody wanted to get in there. Like, all we have to do is just convince everybody this animal is in trouble. This animal's in trouble. And we can make a whole bunch of money. And, of course, they don't have to give it to wildlife management because they can step back and say, oh, no, if you approve of hunting, we can't in good faith give you this money, so we'll just put it right here in our pockets. And this is how that whole movement was born. Mm. And, of course, when something is that lucrative, it ends up turning into a war.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, taxidermists were automatically kicked into that part of the whole thing, and regardless of whether they were artists who hunted or not. You know, a lot of taxidermists I know that don't hunt. Mm-hmm. They just love to bring animals back, and they love the science of it and the whole thing. So yeah, so there's always going to be that stigma, and then of course the art society was pulled onto the other side pretty much. So it's that gap hasn't been bridged for so long, but it is being bridged now, even by a lot of people in your country.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see. The new generation is fixing that.
Well, and there's always been, you know, among the art crowd, you know, a fine line between what is craft and what is art. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most, good taxidermy, of course, requires good craft, but it does cross that line, I think, sometimes into being, you know, more of a piece of art than just craft. And another thing that I ran into, you know, early on in making the movie was that almost every taxidermist that was, you know, my age or older mentioned Norman Bates as a stereotype that they always try to overcome. And, you know, it's not so much with a younger generation who's not familiar with the movie Psycho, but Norman Bates was a taxidermist and just about the creepiest guy on film at the time and probably since. And that stigma really hung over a lot. You know, I heard it over and over again. So I used that, you know, I put that in the movie, and I also used a lot of references to Psycho in the movie. They're kind of sprinkled throughout there. And I think that, you know, that it's something that, you know, they really try to overcome, and it's tough. You know, I mean, that we all, I think, have this stereotype of a taxidermist as a hillbilly, you know, working out of his garage on deer, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the other aspect of this is I presume that people just blankly assume that all animals involved in taxidermy have been killed, which clearly is not the case.
Nope. Well, they've died.
Yeah. Because... Go on, Dan.
Oh, well, you know, that there's no doubt. And in very few cases are animals actually killed for taxidermy. You know, taxidermy is almost always the byproduct of, you know, of hunting for food or sustainability, or in a lot of cases, you know, animals that come from zoos or just die of old age. And, that it's a very emotional issue for a lot of people. So, you know, they can't understand that an animal, you know, they think the animal had to die in order for it to be mounted like this. And of course it does have to be dead, like Ken just said, but it's usually not killed for the reason of taxidermy.
Yeah. I mean, there's always been a tradition, especially in the UK, of people having their beloved pets mounted. Primarily as an emotional reminder or a tribute to them. So it seems odd that this kind of misconception perpetuates the world of taxidermy from the outside.
Yeah, you know, and pet taxidermy has made a huge comeback. You know, mostly in my generation, it was like absolutely something we wouldn't do. But the new generation, the millennials, they're just loving to do pets. It's actually it caught me off guard, you know. So yeah, it is quite interesting to see that come back. And also too, you know, the Victorian era of taxidermy, when they used to do things, you know, where they would dress up mice and have them at banquets and things like that, you know, that's making a comeback too, and it's under the guise of what they call rogue taxidermy. Mm. So, and a good friend of mine from Hollywood, Alice Markham, she does Victorian-style compositions under domed glass, and for a lot of famous people, you know. So there's kind of a renaissance in a lot of ways of it coming around, you know. And I think that people, I'm glad the new generation isn't familiar with Norman Bates so much, and I'm really glad people didn't know that General Custer was also a taxidermist. But so was James Audubon. He was also a taxidermist. So we've had our naturalists, you know. Yeah. And Carl Akeley, who was the guru of modern taxidermy, was the first person to ever lobby to start a national park to save an endangered species. And he is the only reason the mountain gorilla exists today, because he had them set up that park. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot of education about taxidermy, really, that people, you know, could get their hands on. And I think this film touches on a lot of it in a very positive and simple and approachable way, the way Dan has done it.
Yeah, very much so. Well, like I say, I mean, there's a very sweet theme that runs throughout the film, because it's it really does open your eyes to a lot of the people involved. Because the other thing that strikes me about it is it wouldn't tend to be a subject you would associate with women being involved, for example. But there was numerous female taxidermists in the film. Is that something that's a more modern development, or has it always been there?
I would say that you're seeing, like, some of the biggest and best up and comers right now are in fact women. Amy, who was in the movie, was a kind of a pioneer. She was one of the first, you know, and well, I wouldn't say one of the first, but she kind of brought it into that generation, and you know, she now runs a very successful business. And but then we have people like Jan Van Heusen and Jean Roll, who are world champions. Jan, unfortunately, had passed away recently, but now you're starting to see lady taxidermists up and coming that are doing stuff that's just incredible. It's almost like they're taking over.
Yeah, I think Ken's right. They are taking over. I think some of the best ones are clearly women, and I think that you know, the ratios of men to women have really changed. You know, I mean, Ken's generation, it was still, you know, even though there were these, you know, great women taxidermists, and Ken and I know who they are, but you know, it was still 95% men, and I don't think that's the case anymore.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I really found it very interesting, and like you say, as you touch on there, it was especially interesting when you spoke to the lady called Dawn, primarily because she had a foot in both camps emotionally in this film, because obviously she was a taxidermist, a very talented artist, but she was obviously also a Bigfoot eyewitness, and
yeah.
That was very interesting, because I know you've touched it several times, Ken, about how you respond to people who claim to have sightings and stuff in regards to their emotional reaction. And it's very similar to my train of thought when I ever hear a witness, you know, with the greatest respect, I've yet to see one. Obviously, I'm living in the UK. I'm not going to have much chance at the moment. However, I often find it telling that someone, when they discuss their experience, it's very negative. And I know you mentioned it in when you were interviewed on Mountain Beat Mysteries film. It's almost as if they're suffering from PTSD.
Oh, absolutely. I had one witness break down in my shop, and he left two life-size bears here, and he has not come back. I guess they're my bears now. Yeah, like I, wow. Like, and that particular Sasquatch tried to grab him, tried to take him when he was a kid, and that was just to watch the color drain out of his face, and you know, and his and him to slowly lose control of himself was you know, it was I learned something that day, and I approach my witnesses now far more carefully.
Yeah. I mean, for you, Dan, were you surprised? Obviously, because of when you were filming these people and you were seeing, I mean, obviously it was very satisfying to see how many people wanted their picture taken in front of Patty.
Yeah.
Were you surprised when you did meet these people who had this emotional response? Because even if they don't, Bigfoot has become a pop culture phenomenon regardless over the last 40 years. He's everywhere, you know, he's all over the world these days. And a lot of people seem to have taken him to heart as, and I'm not using this term dismissively, as I've touched on in regards to the subject. It's almost as if he's become enshrined into modern American folklore now, fully.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. But it is interesting, I think, when, you know, I've had Patty with me at some events that Ken hasn't been at. And just like, you know, Ken says, you know, if you're a receptive person, I've had people come up and want to tell me their stories. And, you know, I try to tell them I'm not the Bigfoot expert here. I just made the movie about it, you know. But it does. People do. They do want to get it off their chest, I think. And, you know, Ken's certainly, you know, a recipient of that. I've seen it happen at taxidermy shows where people will come up to him and, you know, kind of take him off to the side and they want to tell him all about their experience. And it's surprising how many people have had some kind of run-in with, you know, something that they're not sure that it was a Bigfoot, but they know it was not a bear, you know?
I mean, that's always been one of the skeptical explanations that I've always found confusing, because I think it's Dawn that basically explains why it doesn't make sense. Primarily the square shoulders, the length of the arms, the locomotion. It just seems to be one of those one size fits all explanations that when you really put it under scrutiny in regards to certain witness testimonies, it simply doesn't stand up.
Yeah, well, you know, and the thing is that people need to be cognizant about what other people are saying. But the problem is, there's the old saying that I'll see it when I believe it. It comes into play, and it's I tell people that they need to, you know, they need to be more receptive. They don't have to necessarily judge, but listen to the person, engage whether or not you think they're crazy, you know, but keep it to yourself. But you know, if you got real bad heartburn, but you also have high blood pressure, man, don't just write it off. You know, like, you know, it could bite you. And the thing is, and this is what I did, is I decided to step back and take everything, you know, at face value, not try to judge anybody, and then basically amalgamate it with all the other thing that I have been told and that I've learned and that I've read, and see if I can find common threads and try to build a picture from the pieces. And I'll tell you, there in the hunting community, there are a lot of people who have seen a Sasquatch that will not tell anybody about it.
Yeah. I mean, were you surprised, Dan, like you've touched on there, that people have come forward to you, were you surprised in some of the stories you heard as someone, you know, with the greatest respect, who probably didn't expect that kind of response to what you were doing?
Yeah, I was real surprised, and I still am, you know. Like I said, I had never really thought about Sasquatch before, and, you know, Ken gave me quite an introduction, and then, of course, I did my own research, and then he took me to the area, you know, not far from where he lives, at least not far by Canadian standards. And man, it is just a huge, vast wilderness with not much access, and realistically, it's not hard to imagine that something could exist out there, especially if they were smart and had a nice coat of fur, you know, because it does get cold. But, I mean, humans are living up there too, so you know, it's not really beyond the realm of possibility for me anymore.
Yeah. I mean, has it opened your eyes and made you more open-minded then, Dan, would you say?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly it has. And, you know, I've, you know, before I met Ken and still I spent a lot of time outdoors, and I know that we don't know what happens in the wilderness. You know, I mean, there's just a ton of things we don't know. And some of my research during the movie, I found really relevant. I communicated with this guy that was doing his thesis on wolverines and had been studying them for 3 years and had never seen one in the wild. You know, he had caught some on game cams, but, you know, he's been studying these wolverines and never was able to see one, you know. So, yeah, they're a little smaller, but they certainly aren't any less ferocious, and they're not any less elusive either.
Yeah. I mean, the wolverines. Go on, Ken.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and if you're out there, you'll see their tracks everywhere, so you know they're there.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are one of those animals, especially in the Americas, where a lot of people just don't seem to know that such a creature's out there. They are renowned for being ferocious, aggressive predators who can stand their ground, can't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they're a weasel, you know, they're a weasel, that's why.
Yeah. I mean, you touched on that as well, Ken, when you're on about the adaptations and you know, you're looking at the possibilities of Sasquatch and Bigfoot. In regards to, and you make a comparison with the weasel family, because I think it's one of those things that people just assume that all animals behave in a certain way, and yet we know that's not true, because variations of the same species adapt to different environments.
Well, the environment gives rise to the species, and any pure species is environment specific. There's no two ways about that. The only creatures that that transcend environment are hybrid species, which, by the way, a lot of humans are. The only pure Homo sapiens are Africans. They've done the DNA study. Like, if you're a white person, you're about 5% Neanderthal, and there's a couple more in there that they haven't been able to identify yet. So there's a different mixture of hominid DNA that has made us up. Our history, if we could ever decipher it or go back and see it, would be quite amazing when you think about it, because the Neanderthal was 500,000 years longer in the North Country, to the point where it was the environment was turning it into a different species. Now, when Homo sapien crossed with the Neanderthal, they say that the male children were sterile, but the female were not. And so this gave rise to what we are. And the Neanderthals were also had evolved into planners because of the hostile environment. So they had a bigger brain as a result of being meat eaters. So what ended up happening was you had the invaders who were more aggressive, and then you had the peaceful planners. And then you ended up with these aggressive planners that we are today.
Yes, very true. And I think also we've learned so much about genetics and evolution over the last 30 years. You know, the general consensus, I would suggest, 30 years ago, Ken, was that Neanderthals died out because they were stupid. Now we know that they didn't die out. We basically merged species through, you know, procreation.
Yeah, well, the Homo sapien and Neanderthal gave rise to something that didn't feel like tolerating either one of them.
Well, yeah. I mean, and we've even seen over the last 20 years that, you know, the couple of discoveries in the Pacific that have basically given us a whole strand of what, you know, Homo floresiensis, which is known as the Hobbit.
Yeah.
Which we've got stories from all around the world of little hairy people. And now we know that they existed. So I still find it frustrating that we have to deal with... it's almost as if... certain people follow a certain strand of science and simply don't seem to realize what's happening outside of this pathway that they've chosen for themselves.
The majority of us as a social animal respond best of being told what to do and what to think, unfortunately.
Well, I think you touched on it in the film where you say that people in general are afraid of ridicule.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've seen that fear. That fear transcends all kinds of things, you know. I mean, I don't mind. People can make fun of me all they want, because I can make fun of myself better than anybody else can, so it's not even a contest.
Fair enough. I mean, for you, Dan, did you expect to learn as much about cryptozoology as going into a film primarily going to be about taxidermy?
No, of course not. There's still quite a bit to learn, because there's so much that we don't know, you know. But it is a fascinating subject, and you know, along with that, you learned a lot about human nature, because, you know, one thing about Bigfoot is that, you know, there are these different camps, and Ken and I have talked about this. You know, there are people that just are convinced that there's no way that Bigfoot could exist. You know, and some of these are smart people. And then there's people that know they exist because they've seen one. And then there's a lot of people that think, well, it's hard to believe, but it's certainly possible, and it sure would be cool if we found one, you know?
Yeah. It is definitely an enigma. I have unanswered questions, too, on the whole mystery.
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging as well, Ken, because obviously, as you mentioned in the film, you were a quite young man when you had your experience, which it's interesting, because when you're explaining it, I found it quite telling that your brain automatically assumed it would have to be a man, even though you were in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
It had to be a man.
And why was he so afraid? And why would he even break cover? And it wasn't a big one. I think that there was one, a bigger one, that crossed before. I think that it actually panicked and ran across the road. If I was to reason it out. And the way that thing ran was incredible. If you've ever seen the Memorial Day footage of the one running across that hillside, that's exactly what I saw. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it just didn't make sense that it was a man. Like, it never sat well with me. And it was so fast. And plus, it went up a steep hill without slowing down. And nobody can do that, not even bears. So it was, there was just a whole bunch of things that I witnessed that just weren't quite right. But I was not going to, and the person with me asked if it was a Sasquatch, and I said they didn't exist. And I found out later that the reason the person beside me was willing to say that's what it was is because his grandfather had a farm down in the foothills and used to see them.
Yeah.
And I never ever knew that about this particular person, and they never told me because I probably would have made fun of them,
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a very interesting, it's very interesting the way that the mind reacts when it's taught to react a certain way and not another way.
Well, it's true. I think regardless of which side of the argument, there will always be people that end up, it becomes dogmatic rather than belief driven in the end. It is the be all and end all, Ken.
Yes.
So for you personally, you must have had some kind of internal struggle because, as you quite rightly point out there, you were very skeptical as a young adult in regards to this subject. So how long were you kind of decompartmentalizing this sighting until you suddenly thought, well, it can't possibly be what I thought it was. It has to be a Bigfoot.
Well, I just filed it under, one of my hunting memories. I just filed it under that. And it wasn't until years later when I had two people that I know very, very well tell me, each one told me a Sasquatch story. And, one was a bear hunter that I'm actually doing a bear from. He's very, very old now, and he's still alive. And he found tracks on the Brazos River when they floated it before there was any access in there. And he said, I don't know if those things exist now, but they did 40 years ago because I found the tracks, and they were huge, and they couldn't have been anything else. And I know this guy. He's a premier bear hunter. He had the biggest black bear in Alberta as a record for many, many years. And if anybody would know, and so right away, so I allowed myself to believe that there was such a thing as a Sasquatch, but it was gone. So I actually started in the beginning targeting old loggers, for stories. But then I started getting hits from 2-3 years ago. And then the whole thing started to open up to me. But you see, belief is a funny thing. It doesn't just change overnight. I allowed myself to believe that they were here but not here, and so I was let down kind of easy. And then when I talked to my other friend, and he talked about his grandfather in a logging camp walking out one night, and he ran into one. He literally went home when he got to town because he couldn't go back and tell the people what he'd seen. So that was when my investigation started. Then I started targeting people that if they're out there, this gentleman or these people would probably know. And that's when I found out not only are they there, I found out where they lived and was able to collect evidence.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly seems to have been, you seem to have come full circle to where you were as a child, Ken, as you touch on in the film. And I found that, like I say, when I saw you interviewed a couple of years ago, I was blown away by your very, very straight-mannered approach to it. You weren't going all woo about it. You weren't shouting from the rooftops. You were very calm, very considered, very sensible in the way you discussed the subject, which is what struck me about your interpretation and belief in the situation.
Yeah, and well, luckily I have a background that allows me to be credible. And so, of course, there has been attempts to discredit me. Because there is measured attempts to discredit people who get close to the truth. That's a whole different conversation. But what I always do is I come back to the point where I am a credible person, and you can't make me a not credible person. Now, if you want to call me crazy, fine, you can convince yourself of that. But all these people around here who know me, you're going to have a little harder time convincing them. So it's like a fight for me. It's like a battle. I got my army.
Yeah. Well, I think that's always interesting because I've said this regardless of what kind of phenomenon people come forward with, Ken. I think, especially in this field, you know, and I know you've touched on it a couple of times, and we're both members of a very balanced Facebook Bigfoot group, shall we say?
Well, I'm in a few of them, but I don't know some of how balanced they all are. But there's some very different people in this realm. There's no two ways about it.
Absolutely. I mean, did that surprise you, Dan? Because I'm sure, you know, Ken can vouch for this. You know, there are so many people who have, you know, there are probably four or five camps of theories in regards to this subject matter. Was that something you were aware of before meeting Ken and getting involved in this? Or did you think that everybody just thought it was a big hairy guy in the woods?
No, I really didn't know anything about it, and was pretty quick, you know, during research to see that, yeah, there are those camps. And there sure are some crazy people in those groups. And, you know, they scream the loudest, and they're the ones that probably give people the stereotype, you know, that, well, these Bigfooters are crazy. And then, you know, then you can meet other people like, you know, Bob Pyle, who's in the movie, that, you know, he's about as far from crazy as anybody I've ever met. And so, yeah, there's quite a range of people. I went to I was following one of those really crazy people who got cut from the movie. But went to a thing called the Sasquatch Summit that is held every year in Washington State. And it's one of the bigger ones. Of course, there's a lot of those now, but I think it was one of the first ones. But, you know, the thing I learned is that a lot of the people there have had a sighting, couldn't make any sense of it. You know, their friends think they're crazy when they tell them about it, so they can't really talk about it. So they go to these conventions so they can, you know, commiserate with other people that have the same problem. You know, it's like they're trying to make sense of it. And, you know, I suppose that those gatherings and forums, you know, in this case are a good way for people to, you know, discuss their experiences as well as their feelings.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, I tell anybody, I try to distance myself from what they call the Bigfoot community in a lot of ways because, and it's any good investigator or reporter, like not so much the news reporters nowadays, but if you smell an agenda, run. Don't walk away. Run away. If as soon as you smell an agenda, get out of there. You know, you're in territory that's only going to harm you. You know, this is a problem, and there's a lot of these people that take themselves like more than seriously. They actually think they have influence, and they want this to be true so that their agenda can come to the forefront, and that's really damaging. That's always damaging in any realm.
Yeah, and it is something I've noticed for quite a long time. Even before I took the plunge to start doing this show, I'd been fully aware of everything that had been going on over the last 10 years in regards to these camps developing. And I think my favourite far out theory, not that I support it, is that Bigfoot is actually a slave being used to mine. Areas of North America for their alien masters.
I like that one. Maybe that's my next movie.
I don't know if that's true because you know they'd all end up on the island of Themyscira with Wonder Woman. I think you're gonna be a slave. Anyway, there's all kinds of people that have. Some very interesting theories. Now, listen, I'm going to tell you, I do not discount anything that somebody tells me. If I hear it firsthand, or even if I experience it, and it's in the realm of this is kind of weird, you know, okay, then I will pursue it, you know. Now, I know a woman who saw a Sasquatch very close. They almost hit it with their car. They went back and set up cameras, and there's tracks all over the ground where they were. She showed me a picture. She said the cam tracker kept going off. And she showed me a photograph, and I could make out a ghostly outline of what could only be a Sasquatch. Like, you know. Mm. So you hear about people talking about cloaking Sasquatches. Well, I personally had a picture shown to me that could be interpreted that way. Now, it made me think, but I don't want to go there yet. I just don't want to go there. I need to see more, and I just don't want to go there. And then that thought of that, nothing about this whole thing really scares me, but that does, you know.
Yeah.
So I've seen some weird stuff, but I only, you know, I everybody says, well, every time you see Bigfoot, you see UFOs. I have never had a hunter tell me they saw a UFO and then a Bigfoot, ever.
Yeah.
So I'm not, it's not even on my radar, you know. So there's a lot of strange theories, but I have seen people's memories erased, which is kind of shocking. And then I talked to Adrian Erickson, who told me that he actually talked to a guy that encountered them, and it said that they appeared to be appearing and then disappearing. And he said, but he was disoriented, and he said he realized afterwards that he was having snippets of his memory erased, and that's why they were appearing to do that. Mm. Now, I was able to cross-reference a couple of different things right there. So, you know, I have an electromagnetic theory. I don't believe the infrasound, because every animal has the capacity to interpret electromagnetic energy. Dogs do it. That's how wolf packs communicate. Mm. That's why they're our pets. That's why they are, you know, they have empathy towards our feelings. Mm. So there's a lot of stuff that's bordering on the strange, but with the hunting community, it's really hard to get people to tell you anything strange that happened. But, you know, I listen, and if it's something that's way out there, I keep it to myself. But if something comes along from somebody else to corroborate it, then I'll look at it a little more carefully. But I just don't want to, you know, make up a theory of alien slaves, you know, just because one day, I don't know, I ate a mushroom.
I mean, it is interesting, and when I've spoken to a couple, most of the people I've spoken to are very much in the flesh and blood camp, with perhaps allowing the creature some kind of, as you touch on there, Ken, electromagnetic, or and as you also mentioned there, the infrasound connection, which has been made quite a lot, especially in recent years. And I think it's one of those things that somebody discovers something and then just applies it, and everybody else runs with it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The thing is, but you have to look at evolutionary traits in everything. You know, what kind of animal has a very lowly developed sense of infrasound that they use, you know, that is comparable? Because everything in evolutionary chain has to be has to start here and then develop to this. So, you know, infrasound tends to be more amongst animals, like underwater, and where the sound carries better, where there isn't pollution of the sound. There's just not a lot of it in hominids and primates, you know, as far as something we already know. But the electromagnetic energy, and I use those hex suits for hunting, and that's when I first discovered this, is that if, you know, you have a Faraday cage in your clothes, I've had animals walk up to me and they look right at me and they do not know what I am because they can't sense me. Mm. Even my dog barks at me when I put that darn thing on. So, you know, then you have humans. Humans use sound. But we've taken sound to such a level that we can manipulate it into music, into talking about and making another person understand the mysteries of the stars. You know, poetry, you know, things that make you angry. Like we have a dog which yipes, barks, and growls, couldn't even begin to comprehend what we can do with sound. Now, what happens if this rudimentary electromagnetic energy that we all kind of chip into, what if there's something that evolved it into the same realm, like to the point where we almost can't even comprehend what they can do with it? You know, you have an eel that weighs not even a pound that can create enough electrical energy to kill a man on a horse and the horse.
Yeah.
You know, the electric eel. Well, imagine if an electric eel weighed 1,500 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not out there. It's in the realm of possibility. So I think about things like this. Mm. And, you know, and I can, if I start believing myself, well, then I'm going to end up coming up with some, you know, crazy-ass theories too, but I don't want to do that, you know. I try to think about these things, and then basically if I'm interviewed or if I'm talking to somebody, I try to be as sensible as possible. you know, but there's a lot of things to consider, a lot of things.
Yeah, I've always found it remarkable that, you know, as we touched on there with Electric Eels, there are so many strange adaptations in the animal kingdom from from land to air to creatures in the sea and the rivers. That I often find it incredible that people go, oh, well, these creatures can't possibly do this. And you're thinking, well, if different species can do different things, you know, like you touched on the weasel family, you know, a pine marten and an otter are essentially the same. There they are, you know, they come under the same umbrella, but they are completely different. And if you merge the two, you would probably have, you know, a phenomenal killing machine, really, because it had it could do land, water, and also climb trees for prey as well.
That's right. If a squirrel decides it's going to jump in the water to escape, I got this, you know. that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And we see it all over, you know, there are species of wolves that have developed special white blood cells to acclimatise in certain areas of the world, and bears do it, and we see the way that elephants use sound and whales use sound, and, you know, as you touch on electric eels, and I mean even chameleons, which are incredible creatures. If you've ever had the opportunity to be close to one and just watch one for an hour, the range of colours and things, it's mesmerising.
Well, and it's also too, it's not just, you know, things that are exotic. Look at your starling, you know, your plain everyday starling. In the spring, when they sing, they mimic perfectly the calls of other birds. And I was in Norway with my friend, and of course we were hungover, and that's when we were really funny. And we were sitting out there one day, and there was a starling, and it was singing in the tree. And I was identifying all the different birds, and of course my buddy's sitting there with his cigarette pinched between his lips, and he's, look at this bird. And it's sitting there in the spring, you know, it's mating time, and it's basically, you know, mimicking all these other birds, and I'm identifying them. And he kind of looks at me, and he says, well, why does it do that? And I remember looking back at him and saying, well, imagine a world where everybody wants to sleep with Rich Little. You know? So, I mean, again, nature's amazing, and it's funny.
Yeah, but it's true, though, isn't it? Mimicry is often, you know, even staying in the bird kingdom, you know, the prime example of it is, you know, a creature like the cuckoo, which is essentially a parasitic bird because it just drops its eggs in somewhere else, lets somebody else look after them happily away. And that's a very, very unusual relationship for any creature to pursue.
It is that is a very interesting one, but it is hard to imagine how a bird could be so stupid it doesn't recognize it.
I mean, I've seen footage sometimes, Ken, of birds feeding cuckoos, and the chick's about three times the size of the parent, and you're thinking, at what point do you not think you've given birth to this?
Yeah, well, it's just like, you know, it's just like a female starling thinking that you know, an impressionist is the shit, isn't it?
After a couple of fermented berries, you know, even a starling might look good.
Or mushrooms, ground feeding birds, mouth breathers. Yeah, no. You could go on and on. There's like, look at the birds of paradise and the stuff that they've evolved to do. Yeah. It's you could even make it up. It's so amazing, you know. So yeah. So of course, when I'm dealing with this cryptozoology subject, you know, and things have to make sense to me, so I try to think of the vast realm of strange things that are already out there and try to you know, fit things in that make sense and then theorize on it, you know, because until somebody sits down with a Sasquatch and gets them, you know, to answer questions, you really not or cooperate, you're not going to know anything, really. It is a very interesting, you know, and we talked about the recreations I've done too. I should probably tell you, I learned so much from these animals. Like with Megaloceros, which is the Irish elk. Yeah. When I built that form, I actually made templates at the Smithsonian Institute from the skeleton, and then I basically fleshed it out and carved it. And I wanted to know how in the world this animal could even function with those antlers. And so I learned so many very, very amazing things about the animal is perfectly balanced. You know, if you take a white-tailed deer and then you put its head at the relaxed angle, the antlers have no stress on them because they balance perfectly. You can just set them right onto the form. Mm. The only way you can do that with an Irish elk is if it's feeding.
Yeah.
The only time there's no stress on that thing's neck is when its head is down in the grass, which it would have to be in order to grow those antlers, because they have to grow a new set every year. So it became obvious that when the thing needed a rest, it had to eat. I found that to be extremely fascinating. And I also couldn't figure out how when they were running they could stop. But if he pulls his head back, the way the antlers fall backwards, they go behind the front shoulders, which were amazingly strong, and that's how he would stop. He was a cursorial animal who could run very fast. And then I cross-referenced that with 30,000-year-old cave paintings of people who had drawn Irish elk who actually had seen them, you know, for color patterns and things like that. I looked for, you know, paintings that were made from Cognac and from Chavez that were 5,000, 10,000 years apart and yet showed the same similarities. So basically I would take those as artistic interpretations that were written in stone, you know, from an actual observation. And so it's amazing what you can come up with if you study something and if you try to reason through it. The saber-toothed tiger is another thing. It's, you know, they had no strength in their jaw because they had to be able to turn their jaw completely underneath their throat in order to unleash the canines.
Yeah.
And as a result, they probably didn't eat the entire mammoth. They probably had a tongue that licked most of the flesh off. But there again, nature had a system where it left food over, left over from a kill for the bone crushers like the short-faced bears and, and the prehistoric hyenas. So everything, you know, the rules of nature haven't changed since the days before the dinosaurs. The sun would set and the sun would rise, you know, the night would cool. And so everything has to fit into those parameters. So you can reason through a lot of things. I just have a hard time with the whole alien slave thing, though.
Yeah. I mean, the elk, the Irish elk is a good example because I've been fortunate enough to see a complete skeleton of one in Bristol Museum here in the UK.
They're amazing.
And it is absolutely stunning because they just dwarf anything. And it's one of those things I just thought, wow, that's just... It boggles the mind that, you know, like especially the size of the antlers. They're incredible. I think they were bigger than if I laid down. They were longer than I was.
I'm set here 12 feet across.
Yeah, and I just thought that, you know, it just mesmerized me to the size and the power that even the skeleton gave off. And then about 2 years later, I was getting a late night taxi journey over the through the Peak District in the UK, and. The taxi driver was telling me he made these late night runs quite regularly, and he was basically telling us that the other week he'd seen an enormous stag deer. He said, and it was the biggest thing he'd ever seen in his life, and he thought, you know, old fisherman's tale, taxi driver stories, you know.
Yep.
So it's always 2 foot longer and 3 foot wider than it actually was. And we were literally chatting, and then about 5 minutes later we turned a corner and it was stood in the middle of the road, 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was sweating, snorting, and it's the largest thing I've ever seen in the UK. It was incredible. My jaw just hit the floor.
Isn't that something?
Absolutely.
Well,
and it's one of those things. Sorry, Ken, go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask you if you had seen the actual recreation I did of the Irish elk.
Incredible.
Did you see how graceful it looked? I had it running. It's a very graceful animal, like once you balance it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's not something that just had airplane wings sticking out of its head. It was very unbelievably well designed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is jaw-dropping when you see such recreations. I mean, like I said to you at the beginning, I mean, the care and art, you know, as I'm trying to remember, one of the gentlemen who was interviewed in the film just said you've got magic in your hands, and I think that's... it is true, because there's such a tenderness and a care and a craft in your work that you don't just do a normal mounting of an animal. I think you try and do things to push it, Ken, to make it look more realistic, because your mounts and your taxidermy, they look like they're alive.
Well, the recreations that I did, the person who wanted to know if that's actually what they looked like the most is me. Mm. So basically what I was trying to do was satisfy the hunger of knowledge of what did this animal actually look like. So every tiny little aspect of it I tried to reason through in such a way that it fit into the natural world so that when I put them all together and I stood back, that whether I was showing anybody else or not, I was showing myself because I was the one who really wanted to know. And it's no different than the Sasquatch recreation. Now, I had people telling me to, you know, do a Sasquatch, and I said, well, there's no reference. So I said, I'll look up the Gigantopithecus, and then I realized it's just a jawbone and teeth, and I thought, well, I can't build a recreation of something from that. But then I watched the Patterson film Stabilized, and it only took me a few seconds to realize what I was looking at. Because it's outside human parameters. I could see that. I have a trained eye for it. And I just went, whoa, wait a minute. Whoa, this is real. And then I realized I had reference. So I built what was in that film, and that's all I did. I wanted to see, you know, in tangible 3D right in front of me what that was, and that's what I did.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I've always found compelling about that film, other than the fact that I know enough about really bad monster films, to know that there's nothing comparable to that. I've seen every rubbish film made before 1967, and I've seen every rubbish film, monster film made since, I think. And it made me laugh. I remember once Rick Baker, who's obviously one of the greatest special effects guys ever, who basically just dismissed it. And then if you know anything about Rick Baker, he did a film in 1974, I think, called Octoman, which essentially looks like a man wearing a rubber suit with really crap tentacles stuck to it. And that was made 7 years after. And I thought, okay, right, come back to me when you tell me you didn't make that film, Rick.
Well, I can tell you one point that says it's real on the Patterson film without even thinking, just one point, and that is I made a template from the bottom of the foot from one of the photographs, so I know how big the animal was. It matched John Green's sight chart perfectly. So she was just under 7 feet tall, but her hips were 28 inches wide. Now, if you look at the film, the arms hang straight down, like straight down, poker straight. Now, if you put somebody into a costume, their arms come out at an angle because you can't move their shoulder balls apart.
Yeah.
The shoulder balls on that, from center to center, are about 36 inches. Okay, so go in the gym, find the biggest guy you can find, and take a tape measure, and go to the center of his shoulder joints, and find me somebody with shoulder joints that are 36 inches apart. Mm. You're not going to do it.
Yeah.
And that's just the female, you know. So, I mean, it's the never mind the fact that the arms are longer, that the head is bigger, the legs look smaller, but it's just because the arms are longer, the body's a little bit longer, there's a whole... all the parameters, and of course Bill Munz has touched on this. I mean, he's put it all in a very nice scientific way. But for myself, I just had to look at it, and I knew. So when I made my templates and my charts from the actual frames of the footage, you know, the shin is shorter, which is simian. With humans, our femur and our shin, those bones are about the same length. Mm. And as a result of the shin being shorter than the femur, when it draws its leg forward, and the foot being longer, when it draws its leg forward, it has to go parallel to the ground with the shin, which is something we literally can't do, but they have to do when they walk with a compliant gait. They have to keep their... because if you weigh over 800 pounds, you can't straighten your knees. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff going on there that somebody in 1967 who just finished making, you know, the lizard man in Star Trek isn't going to be able to figure out.
Absolutely. And I've always said as well, one of the aspects of this, if you're going to fake it, why would you use a female? Why make it harder for yourself?
Bingo. Yeah, that's a good point, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that, especially that one. And of course, now, investigating into the hunting community, I know they are flesh and blood animals because I know people who have killed them. Mm. You know, I have ongoing investigations, things like that. So... you know, I know a little bit. I have other things to draw on, so I know they're flesh and blood creatures, and I also know people who find remains that even remotely look human out in the wilderness phone the police. And I also know of people who found strange remains where the whole whole thing has been whitewashed after the remains are taken away. So, you know, there's so much behind the scenes about all of this stuff, you know. So there's things that almost everything about the Sasquatch should be explainable in scientifically one way or the other.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you touched on it. I know you touched on it when you were interviewed by Justin in regards to this. Do you think that this is down to the fact that there is a concern on an official level, Ken, that there are giant omnivore creatures living in remote areas of North America that occasionally are partial to a bit of flesh?
Absolutely, I know this. Like just from the, like I told you, the one witness that I talked to, where the one tried to grab him, he fired 3 shots before he turned it, and he was only 15 years old, and you know, that he was young, and that thing stood there and watched him, and it reasoned out that this human is young enough that they'll just think this human got lost, so I have an advantage here. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're that smart, and of course, you know, I know of other instances too, where they tend to be more dangerous if you try to fool them than anything else. But as far as being a straight predator of people, I think that almost comes down to fit into the same basic dynamic that people do. We meet people every day, and you know, everybody's fine, everybody's cool. But every now and then, you might just walk past a serial killer.
Mm.
You know, so you're talking about individuality, and I think that has something to do with the individuals that actually take people. And it makes perfect sense. It fits into a natural theory. If the thing eats meat, which we know, then there is going to be instances of it being predatory. And throughout the native history, that is what they were known as.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because obviously when I spoke to Chrissy on the show, you heard, Ken, I've always been surprised that these traditions and native folklore seem to have been pushed to the side to this modern interpretation as Sasquatch as some kind of right on hippie living in the woods, gathering berries and nuts and having a nice time and just generally being a friendly, hairy chap.
Yeah, well, it's well documented in history that Daniel Boone killed one.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting. I saw one of his historians being questioned about it, and they said, is it true that Daniel Boone killed a Sasquatch? And the woman said, it's documented well enough that if they exist, he killed one. And 2 members of the party on that incident were killed by this thing before he killed it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to find. It's almost like it gets removed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's out there, and it's, you know, the story of the Sasquatch isn't, you know, before Bigfoot was coined, it goes all the way back to the first people who've come here.
Yeah.
You know, so it if you look, you'll find it. It's in the of course, you know, in those days everything was more religious based, so it was considered a demon, you know, or a dark force or things like that. And then of course nowadays it would be considered something that would basically you know, be an environmentalist's dream. You know, like everybody says, is there an agenda to cover it up? And I says, if there's ever an agenda for anything, follow the money.
Yeah.
That's the only reason nowadays that there's an agenda. It's the only thing that holds water anymore.
Mm.
And yeah, there's an agenda where $1 billion in outdoor, you know, wilderness revenue would be called into question, you know, because of rules that are already in place.
Mm.
So, you know, there is that. Yeah, so it's very interesting.
Yeah. How have you found it, Dan? Were you surprised to kind of peel back the layers of this, and did you begin to think that there's a lot more to this than meets the eye, or?
Well, yeah, certainly. Yeah, I think it still just goes back to we don't really know, you know, what happens in the deep dark wilderness, and you know the cultural appropriation of Sasquatch as a hairy eating hippie is, I mean, it's funny to me, but it is more of a pop culture thing, I think. I mean, if, you know, I think, sure, you know, Sasquatch, I don't want to run into one. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting as well, because when you speak to certain people, like Ken's just touched on there, they assume that Bigfoot started in 1958. And yet, if you even want to follow historical stories or anything, there are hundreds of stories in old Canadian and American newspapers from the 19th and early 20th century where there are numerous stories of people running into wild men.
Yep. Yeah.
Which I found, I'm not sure how you feel about this, Ken. Do you think that that's just people not knowing enough about the subject, or that they want to try and make out that it's a modern hoax?
Well, when you call something a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch or a wild man, but you give the same description, yep. It doesn't really matter what you call it. You know, red eyes, 10 feet tall, and with an evil smell. I mean, it's all of the parameters are there from the 1700s all the way up till now. And so yeah, whether you call it, it doesn't matter what you call it, potato, potato, you know, likely the same thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I find it frustrating sometimes, and I've said this another time. You know, you've touched on it there when you're talking about cave paintings. You know, we have examples all around the world of unknown creatures being drawn alongside established animals that we have zoological records for, and they are always dismissed as fantasies or dreams. And I don't understand how everything else, just because everything else we know of on that wall, we've got skeletons, or we've got animals in zoos or parks or whatever, and yet these are completely dismissed out of hand as ancient fantasies or nightmares.
Yeah, I agree 100%. As a matter of fact, when I watched The Cave of Forgotten Dreams with the Chauvet documentary from France, there was a kind of an unrecognizable painting on the wall that, to me, I thought was a Sasquatch. Mm. And I even sent a frame of it to somebody and said, take a look at this and tell me, compare this to the Patterson creature and tell me if it isn't the same thing. Mm. And they never, ever returned my call, and I just left it at that. But I found it very compelling. Mm. But you would think that that there would be more of it in cave paintings, but then I haven't seen the whole catalog of cave paintings. Usually what everybody sees are what they can recognize. They only catalog the things that make sense to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But that's also something I've thought about a lot. You know, and of course, pictographs from the North American natives have the Sasquatch.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Unquestionably. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the Aborigines do in their cave art as well. They have the Yowie alongside of... Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, go on, Ken.
No, I said I've spoken to people in Australia that have seen them, mm-hmm. in the hunting community, in the taxidermy community. So, and it was really interesting because they were just describing a Sasquatch to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I do love the parallels between Native American and Aboriginal stories of these creatures, because they seem to run hand in hand for me.
Mm-hmm.
There's just too many similarities, which is incredible when you think about the continental difference between them, because there was absolutely no possibility that this could be a cross-pollination of ideas. These people would never have met.
That's right, and it's amazing, too, and how many people around the world are describing the same thing. And even when Jeff Meldrum went to China and looked at the foot casts of the Yeren, he said they were indistinguishable from the Sasquatch.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Absolutely. Hmm. So... Listen, gentlemen, before I let you go, thank you very much for your time today. It's been brilliant to chat to you both. So, Dan, did you, when you finished Big Fur and created this wonderful, sweet film that takes you to places that you don't expect, is it something that you look back on that journey as with deep satisfaction in regards to where you thought the film would start and how it ended?
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with it. You know, you never know when you start these things what's going to happen. And as I tell people a lot of times, if you make a movie about somebody that's an interesting character, you know, and stick around long enough, something's going to happen. And that's what happened with Big Fur. It's been a fun ride. It was my first film, so I learned a lot. And, you know, hopefully we're going to get it out there to the public real soon. It's, I do have a distributor for digital distribution, and that process, you know, just takes a little while. But I think in, you know, 4 to 6 months, it should be available on most platforms to purchase, like, you know, Amazon and iTunes and that kind of thing. And you can keep abreast of those developments by going to my website, which is bigfurmovie.com.
Well, I heartily recommend it. I've, like I say, I've watched it twice. I know for a fact I'm going to watch it again. because I really enjoyed it. I just think it's a lovely film. It's a fascinating subject. Ken's a very interesting subject matter. but I really liked it. It made me laugh a lot more than I anticipated. It made me learn things I had no concept of at all. And I can only thank you for bringing it to us.
Well, thank you. It's good to hear those compliments.
No, my no, and thank you for allowing me to watch it. It was a real, real privilege and a pleasure. So thank you, Dan.
Sure thing.
So, Ken, what about yourself? Where can everybody keep up to date with you and your fantastic creative work?
Well, actually, I haven't really been doing I haven't really been a lot on social media or anything like that with my work as of late. I've been basically trying to transition my business from creating product for other taxidermists and traveling and things like that into, you know, so, but people can look me up on, I mean, I'm Facebook and I'm, you know, you can Google me or, you know, I get people calling me all the time. So, yeah, so I'm not really creating a product at this moment, especially in this realm. I'm just trying to find answers.
And long may it continue, Ken, because like I say, I was struck by your candid honesty when I first saw you interviewed. And therefore, you are someone whose opinion I will always listen to and keep my eye out for.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you again for your time. The very best of luck with the film. It deserves to get all the success that it can. So please fire it up when it drops, released, and I will give it a shout out on here and on our social media as well, and support it as much as I can, because I think it's a fantastic film, and all power to you both. So thank you again for your time and your trouble and your marvelous conversation.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. It was great.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.